Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Wittstock, and in this episode, I speak to Professor Daron Acemoglu of MIT, and we discuss recent research on automation and labor markets.
Hello, Professor Daron Acemoglu.
Hello, Nick. How are you doing? Very happy to be joining you.
I'm good. Thank you so much. I hope you're doing well yourself.
Despite everything, yes.
Amazing. Yeah, it's very good to speak to you. I want to start us off by discussing a recent series of papers of yours together with Pasquale Restrepo, broadly discussing the impact of automation on U.S. labor markets. The common opinion here being that increasingly effective labor replacing automation has undermined economic prospects of Americans with certain skill profiles. What's the insight of your series of papers here? How pervasive is the use of these automated production techniques, and what industries especially employ them?
I think from the point of view of social science rather than the real world, the first thing to note is that, you know, even though this might seem fairly obvious, you know, it's not actually what most economists and social scientists focus on. And part of the reason for that is because somehow we have gotten into the habit of thinking that, you know, technology improves things, improves productivity, and that productivity increase ultimately is going to be shared somehow. Right. And there are good reasons for that under certain circumstances. And I guess the bigger sort of conceptual point here is, and it's very relevant, in my opinion, to political economy, is that actually productivity improvements, technological progress are very often biased. And the politics and social choices involved in that are as first order as when it comes to issues of redistribution, regime change, and all of that. And during certain periods of time, things work out that those distributional conflicts don't become so central. But during the last several decades, I think they have been. And that's why thinking of automation in terms of the future of prosperity is key. And I don't think it's a question of just a discontinuous change that suddenly, you know, robots came and things changed. You know, automation has been going on forever, but it's accelerated, according to our research, in the 1980s. Mid-1980s, and it's been very fast. And a lot of other technological changes that would have been more helpful to workers have ceased. So we're seeing the cumulative effects of these. And in terms of industries, there are many industries that are at the forefront of it, you know, car manufacturing, electronics, metal, but some services as well. I think even clearer is which occupations are being impacted. So essentially, if you're a blue-collar worker, if you're an office worker, back office worker, administrative services, I think those are the occupations that have been at the crosshairs of automation. So they have been very significantly impacted, and that has had an important disproportionate effect on the prosperity of certain demographic groups.
So you mentioned that both the trajectory and impact of the kinds of technological changes that we do see are in some way politically contingent, you know, because people usually refer to the phenomenon that we're discussing here as skill bias technological change. It's somewhat implicit that this is, as you were referring to, sort of comes out of nowhere, that it's somehow endogenous to the technology somehow. And yes. Yeah, it's a natural process, and it's not really a priori clear, or maybe people assume that it's a priori clear that it's going to benefit everyone. Right. But at the same time, you know, you can see that the implicit assumption here in skill bias technological change is that certain skill profiles actually are becoming more valuable.
Absolutely.
Right, which today, you know, tends to be highly educated, you know, data scientists, software, hardware engineers, and so on. Right. We spoke to Enrico Moretti on this program, discussing the emergence of very, very productive cities that are especially focused on those areas. So in what way is this then not a natural phenomenon where the economy has just changed towards a different, you know, production profile? And that's why we're seeing the labor market outcomes that we see.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think natural is in the eye of the is in the eye of the beholder to some degree. I think the dynamics that Enrico is talking about are very, very important. But neither those nor the sort of automation that we're seeing is natural in a very clear sense. They are choices. Mm-hmm. They may not be choices that you and I make, and they may not be choices that a single individual makes or single corporation makes. But they are choices. There are many different ways of organizing production across space, across firms, across skill groups. And there are many different ways of using our common knowledge for technological change. And this is the sense in which I think some of the, you know, quite well-informed public opinions about this question, these questions, in my mind, have to be reevaluated. You know, one is that there is a very common view, both on the right and the left of the public debate, that when we talk of inequality, there are two opposed forces. There is the force of technology, which is taken to be somehow exogenous, outside of the control of the choices that we've made, and other things like unions or perhaps globalization, which were more dependent on choices such as, you know, the unionization, union bashing, and allowing China to enter into WTO. Absolutely, those are important and they are results of choices, but technologies are even more so. We have made a lot of specific decisions for developing technologies this way, adopting them, using them in very specific manners, which is very important for their inequality conclusions. And that's the reason why I don't like the skill-biased technological change literature all that much. I think it's made important contributions, but it is somewhat of a black box view. So there's something technology just happens to be skill-biased. Why is it skill-biased? Is it because it's making the workers with, you know, great STEM skills or MBAs or PhDs much more productive? Or is it because it's actually replacing some workers and reducing opportunities for them? And to what extent we could have done them differently? So I think those are the central questions, both for economics and political economy and politics. And those are the ones we should focus on, which requires really going beyond the black box of skill-biased technology.
Yeah, so what are some of these policy choices that especially American you know, policymakers and I'm assuming business more broadly has been making since the 1980s. Well,
look, there are many of them. There isn't like one sort of turning point, but let me mention a few. I don't want this to turn into a sort of a kitchen sink, but there are several. For one, as government policy, we subsidize capital and we tax labor. So my own research estimates that the marginal tax rate on equipment and software used for automation is less than 5%, whereas the marginal tax rate that you pay as a firm plus the workers jointly when you hire labor is over 25%. So there's a huge gap there that favors firms to use capital instead of labor when they create new jobs. I wouldn't say that's the reason why firms lay off workers. You know, sometimes they lay off workers because, you know, there's automation and that really makes some of those functions irrelevant, but this is particularly relevant when you're creating new jobs or new establishments, new plants. Second, I think it is a very clear choice of many companies, such as Amazon, to use modern technologies for monitoring and collecting data and reorganizing production in a way that is not particularly useful for workers, but it's very useful for their bottom line. That is a choice. But more broadly, I think many companies have followed the lead of Silicon Valley and have converged on a business model that's based on automation. You cut costs by using algorithms and machines. You want to reduce the amount of labor because labor is problematic. It makes mistakes, it makes demands, it's not as reliable. It's sort of like an almost an ideology that says, you know, machines are better than labor. And that, of course, then animates your technology choices, your organizational choices, and then it gets transmitted to researchers who then want to use their common collective knowledge in terms of producing more of the machines that are going to be useful for automation.
All right. So if you were going to make a comparative case here, are there alternative models possibly in Europe that would display a slightly different both economic and technological path?
I think so. And to do that, you know, I would say both in the past in the US and in Europe, you see many alternative models. In the US, for example, in the 50s and in the 60s, there was automation. But in addition to automation, many companies invested quite a bit in their workforces to create new tasks, new ways of using machinery in order to make their workers more productive, partly because there was a labor shortage. You know, the main thing that companies needed was labor. So if you look at what car companies did in the 50s and the 60s, they had a huge appetite for workers. So they would get all kinds of workers, whoever applied for a job, and then they would train them, and then they would adjust their production process so that they could make use of these workers' skills. You see the same thing in Germany in a much more systematic way. It's impossible to think of a manufacturing firm in Germany without the apprenticeship program. And that apprenticeship program prepares workers, and then companies have a much greater incentive to make use of those workers' skills. So you see the implications of that when you trace what happens after a US firm adopts robots versus a German firm adopts robots. In the US, when car companies adopt robots, they lay off their blue-collar workers. In Germany, the evidence suggests that oftentimes they try to find other jobs for the same workers once their tasks have been taken away by machinery. So that is, of course, because they view these workers as very valuable. And that's both a equilibrium phenomenon. There is labor shortage in Germany to an extent that there isn't in the US. It's a vision problem. Firms have a very different approach in Germany than in the US. And then third, it's a social political problem. There are countervailing powers in Germany. So workers' councils, the unions play much more of an important role. You have to negotiate with them, and you have to convince them that automation is a win-win process for both workers and the management. In the US, you know, unions are weaker, and whatever unions there remain, they have a very conflictual relation with the management. So nobody's going to think anything is win-win in that situation. So all of that social context have to be taken into account when you think about how technology is being used.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. So, and the question that would be, or one of the observations that you make in this series of papers is that there is not just labor replacing technologies. There is also innovations that ultimately, as you are alluding to now, enhance labor or reinstate labor in a certain way.
Absolutely. I think that's very critical, right?
Yeah, please elaborate on that point.
Well, I mean, let me give you another... Let me try to illustrate this point with an example from a different epoch. You know, the mother of all automation is the mechanization of U.S. agriculture. You know, in as late as 1860s, you know, more than 50% of the U.S. workforce was in agriculture. And before World War II, already that was a few percentage points, a few percent. So that was like an amazing amount of labor mechanized, reallocated away from agriculture. Was that a disaster? No. It would have created a lot of hardship. Some people lost their livelihood. There's a huge amount of poverty, that's for sure. But in the aggregate, it wasn't anywhere as disastrous as it might have been. Why not? Well, because at the same time, U.S. economy in other sectors created a huge number of jobs. That was the period in which manufacturing became completely modernized, both in terms of production processes, electrification of the workplace, and in terms of, you know, what manufacturing is about. So if you look at the 19th century, you know, manufacturing firms, factories are about putting stuff together. That's it. There's nothing else that goes on in those factories. Now, fast forward to the 1920s and 1930s, you have a very different type of manufacturing firm emerge. You know, it does design, it does maintenance, it has all these clerical workers who are doing cost control, marketing, and all sorts of things. So that whole transformation created millions of jobs in the U.S. economy. And if you think about it, you know, how would have the performance of the U.S. economy have been if all that the U.S. did was to automate and mechanize agriculture? And then all the workers that lost their jobs in that process, they would either have to be unemployed or go and do compete against other workers for doing exactly the same tasks that those workers were doing, cleaning the streets or doing menial construction work or et cetera. You know, it would have been terrible. First of all, we would not have gotten any of the productivity gains that we got in the 1910s, 1900s. And second, the distributional consequences of that would have been terrible. And I think the reason why I am sort of adamant on this point about today is that we're essentially doing that thought experiment. We're doing all that automation, but we're not using technology for creating these new opportunities that we did during that time period and we did during the 1950s and the 60s. And when people raise these points, you know, the technology leaders say, no, you know, all technology is good. We're all going to ultimately benefit when we reach singularity, or you don't understand AI. You know, it's a really sad situation because the public debate has been anesthetized.
Okay, so what's standing in the way of reinstating labor in new occupations, right? I mean, one argument to be made would be to say, okay, well, what needs to happen is for some of the skills and knowledge relevant to, say, digital economy and adjacent industries has to be standardized, right? The problem right now is that there's no way to standardize the knowledge and skill that's necessary to be productive in those areas. And once that kind of knowledge gets diffused, you know, we're going to be able to reinstate labor in that way.
Right. I mean, you know, I think we have to be careful what we want to be standardized. Right. I think, you know, we can make our workforce better at using advanced techniques, advanced mm-hmm. technologies. And that's going to achieve some amount of new job creation. But ultimately, you know, if what you're doing is you're trying to train workers to be better at designing or using AI tools, you're actually creating jobs for like the most privileged 10% of the workforce. Ultimately, if you want shared prosperity, inclusive prosperity, you need to create jobs for the bottom 10%. So that means you need to create jobs for people who are, you know, hopefully everybody will be well educated. They are literate. They understand basic, you know, numeracy, basic social skills, etc. But they're not going to be the designers or the advanced users of AI technology. We need to find ways of making technology usable by a very, very large group of people. And that requires really very concerted effort at making these tools go in the direction of creating new tasks, creating new capabilities. That's what we're not doing right now.
Okay. So, of course, that there is this other big discussion here that is connected to the decline of certain skill profiles in the U.S. labor market. You know, the Trump presidency has focused minds on trade exposure, especially to China, has dramatically accelerated since China joined the WTO. I think pretty conclusively been shown by David Autor et al. And you as well, has accelerated deindustrialization in geographically concentrated areas.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So to what extent, though, is it like, first of all, my question would be, is it possible to really disentangle the effects of trade and those of labor replacing automation and innovation?
Not completely. Okay. And for the following reason, for instance, if you look at a big push in automation mm-hmm. in the 1980s and early 90s, it actually comes because many companies get into this mindset of labor cost cutting because they think they need to be competitive against Japan.
Hmm.
And then Japan is then replaced by China. So yes, globalization and automation are linked. But on the other hand, there are also quite distinct effects. You know, I think I would distinguish three things. The first is offshoring, which is part of globalization. And that has had impacts very similar to automation. My own work with Pasquale Restrepo suggests, you know, not doesn't prove, but suggests that offshoring has had very similar effects to automation, but the amount of offshoring is modest relative to automation. You know, the number of workers impacted by offshoring is about 1/10 of the number of workers impacted by automation. Second, there is the effect of globalization because it has pushed many companies into bankruptcy. So the work by David Otter, David Dorn, Gordon Hansen, and some of my work with them, shows the main impact of China trade has been to push some firms into bankruptcy. So a lot of it is through closures of industries in certain local areas, as you suggested. David Dorn, Gordon Hansen, they are the leaders in this. I'm just tagging along. But the work that we did together, for example, estimates that that's the number of jobs lost due to this China shock from 1990s to the pre-global crisis date, end of 2007, could be as high as 3 million. So that's a very, very significant number. But interestingly, the industries impacted by China trade are very distinct from those that are impacted by automation. So there's some overlap, but furniture, apparel, toys, those are the major industries that are most affected by China trade. And they are not actually that much at the forefront of automation because, first of all, robots are not very good at doing these things. Numerically controlled machinery made very important advances in textiles and a few other places. And impacted those things. But labor is quite cheap in these industries. So it's like when you do the robots, it's very profitable for firms because they're actually replacing quite expensive labor, like car or electronics. So then you can see the effects of the two somewhat distinctly. And in terms of the inequality trends, the decline in the service sector, non-manufacturing sector of jobs that are automated seems to be very, very important. Again, non-manufacturing has not been impacted by globalization. So that's the sense in which you have the robots that are affecting the heavy industry, you have China trade that's affecting light industry, and then you have software-based automation that's affecting, some of the manufacturing, but a lot of the non-manufacturing sector. And non-manufacturing is huge. It's 90% of employment.
Yeah, absolutely. So the cumulative trend being, as you're suggesting here, towards a polarization of labor markets, where effectively you do have significant opportunities for a small set of very highly educated workers benefiting quite substantially from these new arrangements, whereas other workers are either pushed out of the middle towards the bottom or exit the workforce altogether. A related point here, of course, then is the question: we've debated the political determinants of this development to some extent, but another question that is obviously related is what is the political effect of this? And to what extent, and I know this is a topic that is dear to your heart, to what extent is this a challenge to liberal democratic governance? We had Daniel Markovits on the program arguing that skill bias, technological change is endogenous to the rise of a well-educated class. Mm-hmm. He calls it a meritocratic class that re-engineers mm-hmm. the economy and society in its own image. And in the process, especially creating opportunities for itself rather than others. Professor Carlos Boix on this program argued that an economic model in this way that does not really give capitalists an incentive to broadly invest in public goods, as it may be the case in such a knowledge economy, because they rely primarily on robots and highly mm-hmm. educated workers, is in his view not really compatible with democracy, because democracy truly gives a majority of citizens real political power, which obviously in that context would be unstable or not tenable for those people with a lot of economic power. So what is your opinion on both
the genesis? I agree with all of those statements. Okay. I think essentially my research on technology was initially rooted in this directed technological change paradigm, what determines whether you choose one type of technology versus another, and the skill bias of it. And I think that's a critical aspect of what we have done with these technologies. I think the broader directed technological change point is completely correct. I think Daniel's point is very interesting and has legs. I think, however, I would say, a broader political and social change may be more important than just the educated classes wanting technology for themselves. And the reason why I'm saying that is because, actually, if you look at workers who are college graduates, men who are college graduates but don't have a postgraduate degree, they haven't really benefited all that much. Real wages of college graduate men is more or less where it was at the beginning of 1980. So it's really the postgraduate class that has benefited a lot from this. So if you're going to tell, I think, that story with the postgraduate class, that's, to me, a little more validity. But it's also an ideology point. It's really that they believe in a particular way of organizing production. But that is, of course, consistent with Daniel's point. And in terms of, you know, liberal democracy or bottom-up participation, whatever you're going to call it, I think that's right. It does require certain social preconditions. And I would say a sense of community is important. If you don't have that sense of community, democracy is harder to sustain. And that sense of community cannot survive if, you know, society becomes completely two-tiered. The other thing that's very important is a complement to democracy, which is that workers or the broader working class, and I don't mean in a Marxist sense, sort of the working people, sort of the those who are not, you know, in among the richest elite, they don't need to have a class consciousness, but they need to have some amount of bargaining power in society. You know, unions were one aspect of that. You know, they clearly exercise a lot of bargaining power, not just on wages, working conditions, political outcomes. You know, minimum wages, you know, were often supported by unions. Political change was often part of unions' agenda, going back to the Chartists. But now unions are much weaker because labor is much less essential due to automation. So that's another aspect of the change that really sort of makes democracy harder.
Yeah, absolutely. The elephant in the room, of course, being COVID, and to what extent this period that we're living through right now represents a further challenge or a possible opportunity. On the one hand, there's a story to be told of how COVID affects the rate and trajectory of further innovation and automation. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, you could argue that potentially COVID is actually going to increase labor bargaining power and might reinvigorate unions, maybe not unions, but some sort of labor representation. Exactly, or just general concessions to labor. Yeah, so
all of the above. It's too soon to tell. Look, you know, there's so many things that are being impacted by COVID. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Direction of technology has changed quite tremendously. The automation picked up speed, but even more importantly, work from home technology. It's going to have implications. Labor shortages. I think they're changing how people approach jobs, what they accept and what they demand. So that's going to have some effect. That goes, the two of these two go in opposite directions. Third, much more important perhaps, I think what's acceptable in terms of welfare state institutions in the United States has changed. You know, today we are debating whether to accept whether we're going to be able to implement a pared down version of a $3 trillion welfare state spending program, which is what it is essentially. You know, that would not have appeared feasible 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think COVID has really been a wake-up call that our social safety net is completely inadequate. You know, the United States has had so many deaths because of our terrible social safety net. Health is very unequal in this society. Jobs are very unequal. Risks are very unequal. So I think all of those. But on the other hand, COVID is a big boost to authoritarianism. You know, I don't know what's going on in the U.S., whether it has been an additional impetus to NSA swooping information, but it certainly has had that impact in Russia, China, Turkey. So authoritarian governments are strengthened. Some of authoritarian governments are strengthened by COVID. So which one of these trends is going to be defining when you look at it from the vantage point of, say, 2030? I don't know.
I heard a slimmer of optimism in the early part of your answer. So let us maybe try to close on that.
Certainly if you're looking at it from the vantage point of the US labor movement, Amazon confronting unions, Starbucks becoming unionized, additional leave, maternity leave, child support, $15 minimum wage becoming a possibility, I think all of those would not have been possible in, or would not have appeared possible in 2018. I mean, I actually think personally that Trump changed some of that too, you know, for all of his terrible, awful consequences. He also changed, you know, what Democrats would view as feasible. I think it sort of disrupted the system. So I think even without COVID, some of these things might have come up and at least debated. But certainly Republicans agreeing to the original COVID spending plan, that was COVID.
Well, Professor Doron Acemoglu, thank you so much for being part of the PE Forum podcast.
Thank you, Nick. It was great to be sharing these thoughts with you.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Wittstock. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.